podcast land, and welcome back to the Front Row Podcast, podcast for people who actually like movies, and Monster Cast Month continuing here on the Front Row Network on NPR Illinois with another episode of Full Disclosure. And man, oh man, Sarah and I are very psyched today because we are talking about the sequel series to the limited The Haunting of Hill House on Netflix. That's right, we are breaking down The Haunting of Bly Manor. As I said, I'm Jeremy Geckman, the editor-in-chief, here with me, as always, breaking down anything creepy and crawly, my wife, Sarah Baltusevich-Geckner. Say hello.
Hello.
This is good. Man, we are logging some hours
here. Hello.
Yeah, hello. I'll just tell you, this podcast is going to be perfectly splendid.
It's going to be perfectly splendid.
Here's a fun drinking game, guys. Drink every time we say perfectly splendid.
Perfectly splendid.
Yes, it has to be with the accent, though. Just absolutely loved The Haunting of Hill House, as I'm sure every single person who watched it did. Just a modern masterpiece in both of our minds here. So naturally, you got the sequel series here, The Haunting of Bly Manor. So we jumped on that. It released October 9th. We finally finished it. And yeah, I mean, there's just so much to talk about with this series here. You know, it's different. It's very different from Hill House. I think that a lot of people are probably going to be upset with that. I think that they are closing themselves off to something that is really quite brilliant here. But we're going to get into that. So, look, right before we start, though, as always, this is full disclosure rules on everything here. We are going to spoil it. We're going to act like you were sitting there watching every episode with us. So if you don't want to know the details of Bly Manor, and trust me, you don't, you need to stop this, pause it, watch the series, and then come on back to it. But there you go. You have been warned. So Sarah, why don't you give your first overall impressions here of The Haunting of Bly Manor? Especially with how it compares to Hill House, just a big overarching 20,000-foot view.
Okay. Well, I mean, yes, it is in the same series.
It's in the anthology.
But it's not fair to compare them because they're completely different animals.
Yes, very
and
much.
They're both wonderful in their own right.
Yeah,
like, I mean, now Hill House, when it came out, it was just like a whoa.
Yeah.
It just came out of nowhere, and it was like, holy crap, that was good.
Yeah, I mean, we didn't do a full review of Hill House.
We didn't?
No, we didn't.
Oh, man, we probably should.
I mean, like, yeah, Hill House was just such a game changer in the way that it told its story, like the way it kept going back and forth, but how every single aspect of all of those stories was so unique and interesting and like building towards this like culmination, like Avengers episode. And it was just everything about that series was absolutely genius.
Just so many, like,
so many great scares.
So many great Easter eggs. Like, storylines open, but they found a way to like perfectly resolve all of them.
Every single one of
them.
And it just,
I don't know. It was just masterful.
Yeah. It's a masterpiece. But
so yeah, as soon as I heard that it was like, you know, cause we all thought it was just like a one-off, like this.
Right, that's it, you know. Like,
and then we hear, like, this isn't a, you know, American Horror Story kind of deal where it's like a, there's
some
several
of the same
different
actors,
hauntings.
Yeah, and a
and
bunch
I was like,
of different
oh,
hauntings.
Man, yes. So it was really, you know, one bright spot in this turd of a year to know this.
I know what our next Patreon t-shirt is.
Coming on. And I just remember, like, counting down the days, and then we had to go to a wedding this weekend, and like we got back, we were home on the 11th on Sunday, and I turned on the TV and I was like, oh shit, Bly Manor. So I was like, the kids aren't allowed to talk today. Mommy and daddy have something to watch.
We're watching something.
So overall impressions. Bly Manor is much slower moving.
Yes.
So you definitely have to commit.
I would call it more deliberate, you know, like it's a slow burn. It is a slow burn, but it's not because it doesn't have anything to say, you know, like
they're both character studies, but Bly Manor just takes a longer time to individualize each character.
That's a good one.
Hill House is a character study as a familial unit.
Mm-hmm.
This is more of like I mean, each character has their own kind of moments. It takes a while to get through, you know, like that to scratch the surface on each character before things really start happening.
Yeah, I hear you. Like in Hill House, you know, you really, I just said you can't compare these things, and now we're just going to compare them, aren't we?
Well, I mean,
you're right. Like, though, like we, are introduced to this family unit, and like, you know, we kind of understand them as this family unit. We're in, like, looking at them together. You're right. We have to take a little bit more time with setup in Bly Manor because these are a bunch of different people, you know, who are coming together right. at this one place. But we have to really establish, you're right, some of these characters and their relationships to each other before we can really get into the big action of, yeah. of the narrative of Bly Manor itself.
And something that, you know, they say in the end of Bly Manor that you need to know to watch it overarching is that you shouldn't think of it as a horror story.
Yeah.
It's a love story.
Yeah.
Surrounded by horrific events.
Yes. And I will tell you this, and I'll call out your one of your best friends and one of our favorite Twitter personalities, Courtney Enlow, tweeted about this and said, you know, like, horror, you know, encompasses a lot of different things. You know, a horror film doesn't have to just be grotesque or scary or, you know, like jump scares or anything like that. It can be something like this that has horrific events around it that inform, you're right, like a story that's about love, but, you know, the tragic side of love and the sacrificial side of love, you know, and like, you know, and you're right, because like at the end there, when she says that, you know, it's a love story, not a ghost story. And, you know, but what is Carla Gugino's character's response to that, the storyteller's response? Same thing.
Yeah.
You know? And I mean, like, it kind of does serve that purpose. But you're right. And I totally agree with you, though. Like, the love story aspect of all of this, there's a lot of different love stories
at play here. I was gonna say, it's not one love story. Yeah. It's several love stories.
There's a lot of different love stories at play here. But all of them work. All of them really land, especially by the last episode.
Yeah. I'd say, like, once you get to the middle of the series, it just starts picking up
yeah,
steam.
Like, and I... So, to be fair, with your first point there about how it's a slower burn than Hill House is, yeah, it takes about what till like episode four-ish
to
really start moving with narrative. A lot of the rest of it is a lot of setup and a lot of, you know, getting us there. But you're right, like, there's not a lot of, or there are like scary elements that happen. You know, we keep seeing this weird, you know, shadow figure that Danny keeps seeing with the glowing eyes. That's always, mm-hmm. you know, that's like one of the first things we see when
I think even when like in the absence of seeing the actual ghosts or figures, it's just watching kids see things that the adults don't see is freaky enough.
Yeah, like just seeing young Flora like look over Danny's shoulder and just like keep looking
at like her
at
constant need to keep her nanny in bed, to keep Danny in bed, and so she's not walking the house at night. It's like, what do these kids know that we don't know?
Yeah, you're right. There's a great sense of foreboding danger, you know, like but you can't quite place your fingers on it.
Right.
But again, there's also like tons of the stuff like from that we saw from the trailer, like where Flora's in the basement or something, and you know, you see something like creepy crawling, like making this weird noise, and she just turns around and is like, shh, you know, like it's no big deal. And
the kids
stuff
have
like
kind
that.
Of grasped what's going on in the house before the adults, better than the adults.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I guess we should probably give like
a big overarching thing. So yeah, like if you need a little refresher here, the main character of the show, I would say, is Danny Clayton.
Victoria Pedretti.
Yeah. From the first season of Hill House,
Nell.
Who played Nell, Crane. And so she is an American au pair who's come over to England to try and...
She's experienced some loss in her life.
Yeah, she has some demons following her around, but she's trying to make a fresh start. So she applies for this job as an au pair and teacher to two children at the Wingrave children at Bly Manor. That is Miles, who is 10 years old, and Flora, who is, I think, 7?
8.
8. There's 2 years between them. So once she goes there, she's hired by their uncle Henry, who is chronically drunk, played by Henry Thomas, of course, Hugh Crane, young Hugh Crane from the first season of Hill House. And, you know, so he hires her, but, you know, we get the sense very early on that he is not involved, that he's very away. And, you know, it looks like aloofness. It looks like, you know, can't be bothered to be there type thing. But there's a lot of trauma that goes into that. But she is hired there. But then once she gets there, we meet the rest of the staff.
Yeah. And that's the gardener. Owen, or no, that's cook. Excuse me, the cook Owen. He's the chauffeur too. He drives Danny to Bly Manor, and then there's the gardener Jamie,
mm-hmm.
and then there's the housekeeper, Mrs. Hannah Gross.
Yeah. So those are basically your big cast characters there. So Danny's job is to live at Bly Manor and to teach Flora and Miles in a homeschool situation.
And she is the second nanny that they've had.
Yes.
They had a nanny.
Yes, and so there's a lot of tragedy tragedy that has followed the Wingrave kids.
Their parents have died. The parents died on a trip to India mm-hmm. 2 years prior.
Yep.
Then they had another nanny named Miss Jessel.
Rebecca Jessel, yes.
She died at Bly. She drowned herself in the lake. Or
yeah.
drowned. They don't know that she... They just know she drowned in the lake.
Yeah.
And then there was a associate of Henry Wingrave's named Peter Quint.
Mm-hmm, who was always around.
Was always kind of hung around Bly and had been dating Miss Jessel before she died, and he's been missing for some time.
Yeah, and presumed that since there's a lot of money that was missing from one of deceased Dominic Wingrave's accounts, that you know, it's presumed that he took off with this money and that he is just kind of out. Out and about, you know, thieving around, I guess. So that's the basic setup there. And so as Danny is there at Bly Manor, a lot of strange things start occurring. Little 10-year-old Miles starts getting a little rapey a few times.
Kind of like watching her change and like stroking her hair.
Whispering in her ear.
Flora's got weird faceless dolls that she's very particular about.
Talismans.
But she won't let anyone touch any of the dolls in her dollhouse. And she's very particular about
legit.
It's literally Bly Manor. It's humongous. And it has like electric lighting.
That's not like a dollhouse I've ever seen.
No, my Barbie dream house did not have electric
lighting. Yeah, I don't think so.
So
things just keep getting in, you know, consistently more and more strange for Danny. She keeps seeing Peter Quint around, but then he keeps disappearing. You know, there's just all this sense of unease. You're right, the children keep telling her to, like, she can't leave her room at night, you know, that it's not safe, just a lot of foreboding things, and eventually we just start to learn the backstory of Rebecca and Peter's romance.
This show does well, which is the same thing that Hill House does, is the jumps.
Yes.
Nothing about it is linear. Every episode is, you know, you have to think for a second. Okay, wait, when was this? It jumps back and back.
Especially episode five. Just prepare people.
Yeah, episode five is literally just like
Hannah's story,
but in like 40 different time periods.
Yes, but you're right. But this is something that Flanagan has done even all throughout his movies, too. You think back to Oculus, you think to Dr. Sleep. You know, he's very good at doing this jumping back and forth stuff to not, like, to give us more context at what's happening in the present moment.
Right. So we get a jump back to Peter and Rebecca's relationship. Mm-hmm. They kind of had a fling, a romance at the in the house, and, you know, he would come and go and stay with her, and they...
Yeah, and you get the real sense, like, and this is what I really appreciate about this piece, is that the people you think are the villains, they're definitely villainous, but they're not villainous just because.
Every character has so much depth that it's like, you can't really be mad at anyone.
Yeah, I mean,
really?
You could try. I guess Viola's the only one, but she has a very tragic, circumstantial backstory there. Yeah, exactly. But so
really random, awesome swing towards the end.
But, exactly. Yeah.
So Peter and Rebecca have this relationship, and you know, she kind of falls head over heels for him, and he wants her to leave with them, and she wants to, and then he just kind of disappears, and only the kids know what happened.
Yeah,
to them.
And I mean, we get these bits of dialogue. I think Miss Gross and even Owen says, you know, like how you know, like Rebecca after Peter disappears is like she just continually keeps deteriorating. And, you know, like getting more and more withdrawn until eventually they do. Flora actually finds her in the lake, you know, and one morning. And like, so they think, you know, like Peter just broke her heart to the point where she just killed herself is what they presume. But of course, it's a little bit more complicated than that.
Yeah. So, I mean, basically there's this. You know, we get the sense that there are ghosts in the house. They start seeing more things.
Yeah, we see them all over the place.
But there's this one ghost that kind of pervades the air all the time, and that's this woman ghost.
Yes.
In a long, dingy nightgown with long hair, and she has no face. It literally kind of looks like molded clay.
Yeah, almost. It does almost. Whatever they did for that, like, it's a very terrifying effect. But we see glimpses of her a lot.
Because, she's constantly dragging muddy footprints into the house, which everyone attributes to the kids going out at night.
Yeah, so we see traces of her, and then every once in a while we get a very brief look at her.
Uh-huh.
And there's one very effective sequence, I think maybe episode 6, where we actually first see her. But you know, it's like Danny is drunk for some reason one night.
Yeah.
But she's going down to like just get like this extra bottle of wine or something. And as Flora wakes up from her bed, she sees the talisman of this woman in the house, and she just freaks out. And her and Miles are just running around. And like as they find Danny in the hallway, they like make sure that she keeps her eyes on them. And in the background, we see this her. Woman walking very deliberately, you know, not looking for anything in particular, just walking. And we learn out that learn pretty in episode 8 of this, the second to last episode, why.
But yeah, then she, so her next big, she ends up killing Peter.
Yeah. So So as Peter is about to leave, and there's a little big reasons why one night, he like all of a sudden turns around and boom, there's this woman from the lake, that, just grabs him around the throat and literally just strangles him to death and then drags his body back into the lake. And that is where he has been. So Peter, like as Danny keeps seeing Peter around,
Danny isn't crazy. She's seeing him, but she's seeing his ghost.
And that just gets into this crazy, crazy, craziness about the end. So I'm trying to figure out if we should do, because there's like the two episodes, the last three episodes of the series, 7, 8, and 9 are really where most of the action happens. And I don't know.
There's like three stories. There's like Peter and Rebecca, mm-hmm. then there's the old story, the Viola story, and then there's the ending.
Yes.
So basically, let's see, Peter and Rebecca first.
Yeah, which we've already kind of accounted for there. Right.
What we didn't say was that what ends up happening to Rebecca is that she thinks that Peter has left her. She is devastated, but not enough to kill herself. She's very sad. She misses him, but he eventually appears to her as a ghost and kind of teaches her the ways of being a ghost. You know, like he's trying to figure out, like, he can't leave Bly, you know, and even when he kind of realizes that he can inhabit her body, he still tries to leave Bly inside of her, but he gets thrown out.
Mm-hmm.
So he finally realizes that you have to be invited into someone's body for it to actually work.
Mm-hmm.
So he eventually gets Rebecca to invite him in, and by promising her that they'll be together, he has a plan, and his plan is to inhabit her body, make her kill herself so that she's a ghost with him. So her drowning was him inhabiting her, killing her.
Harsh move, man.
So the second half of his plan involves he and Rebecca then kind of skeleton key style inhabiting the children.
Yeah, and kind of manipulating them in like, and I told you, like, there's a, like, it's a sequence where Danny is actually tied up in the attic with them, and and he sees, she can see Peter and Rebecca's ghost. And yeah, it's just like Peter just keeps like reasoning with the children, like telling them why they need to do this. And it just, God, it feels so dirty and so like, manipulative.
He's basically, like, saying to them, like, because what happens when someone inhabits you is that you get to go into another memory, and they call it being tucked away
and like kind of dream hopping or something like that.
So they're basically telling the children, like, if you let us inhabit you, you know, you'll be safe tucked away with your parents.
In the forever house.
Right.
Yeah.
So, and then by this, I think if you're invited in, then I think if they're inside the children, then they could leave Bly.
Yeah, which, you know, pans out later.
And so that's that section of the story.
Yeah, and so, you know, at the end of that particular episode, Danny does get away because Rebecca can't go through with inhabiting Flora. Peter does take over Miles, but, you know, Rebecca kind of, like, tricks Peter, and as he goes off to try and get rid of Hannah, you know. Like, Danny and Flora are about to get away, but as Flora is freaking out because she wants Miles, you know, Danny is, like, trying to run away and turns around and boom, ghost lady from the lake, like, right in her path, grabs her by the throat and is just dragging her away. And that leads us into episode 8, which is, I would say, the best episode of the series.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on what your taste is, but, like, we like historical stuff
this. And you're right, it's the lore.
We both really like Kate Siegel.
It's the lore building and Kate Siegel.
And we love, if you listen to our Are You Afraid of the podcast, all I ever talk about is backstory,
Give us a good backstory, and this one's great.
It's a great backstory.
Because this is literally kind of the origins of Bly Manor, which I'll condense as much as I can here because there's a lot of richness.
17th century, two daughters, Viola and Perdita, whose father was the owner of Bly Manor. He passed away, and so they had no real claim to it unless they were married.
Yeah, so Viola marries one of their cousins, Arthur Lloyd. To retain all this stuff. And you know, it's kind of a business transaction at first for her. She's kind of playing him, but eventually she learns.
And she is a commanding woman.
Yes.
Even though she's married to a man, she is the
who
presence.
Runs
she runs
girls.
Everything. Yeah. She collects the rent. She doesn't mess around.
Yeah. So, but eventually she actually does learn to love Arthur.
And they have a daughter, Isabel. But then she comes down with the black lung.
Yeah. Not the black lung. Well, no, like consumption, I guess, tuberculosis. And you know, like this is very hard because she can't be with her daughter.
And
you
they
know,
call it her living around. Death, which is a really good way to explain it.
Actually,
she's basically, they take they
and
put
the
her
makeup
into
effects here are fantastic.
Another
just
room
break
in the
her
house.
Down,
she can't wear any of her fine clothing. She can't be around her family.
Yeah,
she's just kind of withering away. But she's dead, but she's still there.
Yeah, and
it's
I love
awful.
And they actually like make mention. It's like the doctor says, like, you know, a few months is how long she has, and she literally goes on for
six years.
Because
yeah.
And a lot of like the storyteller Carla Gugino, and this is literally just like, you know, just by sheer will,
stubbornness.
Like just sheer stubbornness, she just kept going and going. But yeah, eventually, you know, she starts getting very resentful of Perdita and Arthur.
She's feeling like she's being replaced.
Yeah, exactly. And it's hard because she wants to be with her daughter, but you know, they can't have her daughter around her because it might get her sick and stuff. So, you know, eventually she gets more and more violent and lashes out at Perdita a lot. And eventually Perdita ends up killing her, smothering her to death.
But before she dies, she puts all of her beautiful things, all of her lace and her silks and her clothing and her jewels
into
in a trunk.
Locked trunk.
And she makes her husband promise that he won't do anything with it. He'll save it for their daughter, Isabel, when she comes of age.
Yes.
It's basically like the one thing that she can do for her
daughter.
Yeah,
and a big security policy too, you know.
So he follows, you know, he locks it up and locks the keys up in a drawer. And seals them, and you know, so.
Yeah, and then time goes by, and Perdita gets more and more jealous of it. Now she uses the excuse of the manor.
Well, Perdita marries him.
Yeah, and Perdita marries him and stuff, but like, she uses the excuse of, you know, the manor's not being managed well and they're getting in debt and stuff, so let's open up the case, sell all that stuff so we can, you know, right the ship and everything. But really, Perdita's just jealous of this stuff. She wants this valuable stuff.
Isabel doesn't love her, you know, she's just not. She thought with Viola dead that she would be in the spotlight, but it didn't happen, so she wants to open this trunk. So she takes the keys and she opens it, and upon opening it she goes to like pick up one of the dresses,
and in one of the few jump scares of the entire thing,
Viola's arms just come out of this dress and strangle her to death and kill her.
And again, makeup, man, she looks so brutally gross after this strangling.
Yeah, so basically they give this long explanation of how, you know, Viola, you know, after she died she kind of awoke and she was in a room that she couldn't get out of, and so she just for, you know, time and time again, she would sleep, she would wake,
she would walk around. Yeah.
And so basically, you know, it comes to the realization that she is inside this trunk.
And I gotta tell you,
her spirit is.
This is again where great writing comes in, because the way the storyteller is telling us this, you know, like just the manner of the voice, you know, it's just like she slept, she woke.
She walked.
And it's just like all of these things, it's just so innocuous. And then like as the story gets more and more sinister here, you know, like, you know, she eventually, after she kills Perdita, you know, and it gives a great perspective of her, like, you know, she's literally waiting for years and years for her daughter to open this
trunk.
So she can see her daughter again. And then she sees her jealous ass sister who killed her right there.
Open it.
And so, yeah, she reacts with this killing thing. But because of that, the downplay of this, or the downturn, is that Arthur and thinks that this thing is like cursed now.
Yeah.
So literally as they're leaving Bly Manor, and as she's like, oh great, we get to go somewhere,
I'm
get to be
with
them,
my family.
They literally throw the trunk to the bottom of the lake.
At Bly, yeah.
And so of course she just gets more and more frustrated and stuff.
So she's stuck at the bottom of the lake, and she keeps coming out of the lake, you know, and first, you know, when she walks on the lake, she looks like herself. She walks the house and she searches for her daughter.
Right.
But as she
always
lays
the same
there,
path too. Always to the room and always back.
Yep, always to the bedroom and always back. And as she lays at the bottom of the lake for years and years, she begins to forget.
Yep.
And every time she comes out, she goes and looks for her daughter again, not remembering that time has passed, not remembering that they're gone.
Yep. And what does the storyteller tell us? She sleeps. She wakes.
She walks.
She walks. Again, same inflection, even though this is getting more and more sinister.
And as the years go by, as she forgets more and more, she begins to lose her face.
Yes, but she does eventually then, as she's looking for her daughter, like the manor starts getting inhabited by people again. And anybody that gets in her path, she strangles the crap out of them, kills them, and they become
continues
the ghosts of
walk.
The manor. And
yep.
She just keeps going. So this is literally, and the way that the narrator describes it as well is that, you know, it's like this gravity that she has. has. Like, just as these ghosts are just like
they're stuck in her gravity.
Stuck there in her gravity.
And the ghosts themselves, they the same thing happens to them. The longer they're there, the longer that they forget, they lose their faces.
Yeah, the faces just start
Perdita
to fade
away. Is dead. Her face, she's faceless in the attic.
Right.
And there's a plague doctor, and there's a young boy that Viola killed. There's everyone that
oh,
she
man,
killed.
Oh man,
that
in
the
one
house.
Killed me so
yeah, she
much.
At that point, she picks up this little boy, just not even remembering that she had a daughter. She just knows she had a child.
Right. And so
she
picks
just
up
carries
this
him
little
into
boy,
the lake.
Just carries him into the lake and kills him. Like, yeah. It's. Oh, God. And again, see, like, that is a very, very grotesque, sinister thing. And still, like, as this is happening, as we're watching this action, it's literally she walks, you know, like, and even though she's walking with this boy and we know what's about to happen, you know, it's just like the storyteller doesn't even give us any hint that there's something unusual here. Again, just great writing, great
yeah,
execution.
It's just, the whole thing, it's just, I mean, what's so great about it, I kept thinking, like, that when it started, it was going really fast. I was like, is this a really short episode? Because like it got through the like the story part of it, but it's that long. It's the explanation of her in the trunk and her at the bottom of the lake. It's that whole. It's so beautifully written.
And it's just it gives you like this almost clinical thing about why a ghost becomes violent and vengeful. You know,
yeah. I mean,
it's
this. Like, you know, she is a vengeful, awful spirit, but it's also like.
Well, yeah, I get it. Yeah, but then I mean, like we like it bursts us back into the action, and this is really where the crux of the story, the last episode, is. So again, big spoiler warnings here, but you know, like it all seems lost. Like Danny is hopelessly there. Flora eventually throws herself on the bed in the room and
lets her Viola take her. Viola thinks she's her daughter, so she picks her up, takes her to the lake.
Viola's taking her down.
Everybody
with her.
Henry shows up, tries to get in her way and stop her. You know, everyone that gets in her way, she just. Cold cock strangles and
so
goes
eventually
to the lake.
Literally as both their faces are just about to submerge, Danny, after being strangled for that long, pulls herself back up somehow in the lake and does the chant that Peter told Miles and Flora they had to do to let them in, which was you, me, us. And as she says this, Viola turns around, faceless Viola turns around, and the next thing we know, we see Danny holding Flora. So the implication here is that Danny ends now inhabited by Viola.
Yeah, Viola was allowed to move into Danny's body.
Now she doesn't take her over at this point, but you did notice, again, just some small little freaking awesome details here is that after this point, Danny now has two different colored eyes.
She has her one blue eye that she's had the whole time, but then she has one darker, like one, hazel brown eye like Viola.
Like Viola. So, just God, the attention to detail. But eventually...
She can, and Danny says, you know, she can feel her inside of her, but you know, she knows she can feel that she's there, and Danny's basically just biding her time.
Yeah, it's just like she's like this beast that's just waiting.
So, you know,
there.
Basically, they all wrap up their affairs at Bly. Henry takes the kids to America to live, he's gonna raise them because we didn't say this, but actually, Flora is Henry's.
Yeah, there's a lot of backstory there. Henry like had an affair with Charlotte, Flora's mom. Flora actually is his daughter, had a big falling out with his brother.
Yeah,
Dominic.
A lot of the reason why he stayed away for so long, but he finally decides, you know, to take his responsibility with the kids.
And you know, it's really great, like this little section here at the beginning of this episode where it like kind of feels like everybody gets their happiness a little bit.
Yeah, he's taking the kids and, you know, even though Hannah Gross is dead, Owen, you know, pays his respects to her and he makes sure she's well taken care of
and
well
remembered in his new restaurant eventually.
Yeah. And then, you know, Danny and Jamie, the gardener, who are in love with each other. Mm-hmm. You know, Jamie's backstory was that she had a fiance who was a childhood friend.
Danny's backstory. That's what I thought you said Jamie. No. Sorry.
Danny's backstory is that she had a childhood friend named Edmund that she was, you know, just loved as they were just the close their whole lives, and he was wanted to marry her. They were engaged,
but Danny's kind of gay.
Yeah.
So
she loved him, but not in that way, and she didn't know how to tell him.
But when
when
she broke off the engagement, she ended up inadvertently killing him
By a car. So she finally kind of gets her happiness with Jamie.
But you're right though. It's like there's just this prevailing beast in the dark. Darkness there waiting for her, but they eventually do get to share a couple of years together.
Yeah, like 10 years together in Vermont. They open a flower shop together.
Yeah, yeah.
And they have like a civil union and give each other rings. And but all this time, you know, Danny, you know, they take it day by day. And towards the end, there after about 8 years, Danny starts seeing when she sees herself in a reflective surface, she sees Viola.
Starts seeing Viola's faceless form. Yeah,
and so she, you know, she's getting scarier and scarier. And then eventually it comes to a time where she wakes in the middle of the night and catches herself
about to strangle Jamie.
So then she knows at this point that it's time. She has to go.
So she leaves a note and, oh God, it killed me so much. Like
Jamie finally gets to Bly.
And as she swims to the middle of the lake, swims down and sees Danny's body.
But now, you know, all the ghosts have been already freed by Viola's inhabiting of Danny. And now they, you know, they'll say the Lady of the Lake will never haunt Bly again
because
Danny
now it's Viola and Danny. And she would never let that happen. And, you know, Danny has this nice dress on, you know, so like clearly she was meaning to do
this on purpose. Jamie begs her to take her with her, but
And so the big reveal at the end here is we learn that the storyteller this whole time, Carla Gugino, is actually grown up.
Did we say that there is a storyteller?
Yeah, I've been saying that there's a storyteller.
Did we say at the beginning, just like this?
Yeah,
Carla Gugino shows up at a wedding.
Yeah, there's this wedding party that's happening, and the night before the wedding,
she sits down to tell them a ghost story, and that's how the story kind of gets started.
But the big reveal here is that Carla Gugino, the storyteller, is actually Jamie, grown up, still waiting,
telling
for
the story at Flora's wedding, and Flora doesn't, they don't, nobody at the wedding remembers it because, I mean, Owen maybe, but the kids, they, Owen tells them in the past that the kids don't remember what happened.
Yeah.
Their memories have kind of been wiped away.
They've been kind of wiped away and stuff like that. But yeah, for all these people being there, you know, in that, but that's kind of the fun part about this is we see all these people at the beginning and then we see all these other people playing, you know, Owen and you know, Jamie and
Henry
and stuff. But at the, you know, there's this wonderful end sequence set to one of Sarah's favorite songs,
I Shall Believe.
Where, you know, Jamie is just kind of looking over all these people and, you know, eventually we see their counterparts like kind of switch places with them.
The story counterparts.
So we learn that
at first
these
you were like, it's Owen's
ones.
Kid. I was like, no.
I know. I did not get it for a second.
These are just like the way she portrayed them in the story. The people that we're seeing now are the real them.
Yeah, exactly. So, and it's,
and she even says
gorgeous.
The little Flora, the bride, she says, you know, Flora is my middle name. It's weird that
she changed names
to protect the innocent.
Yeah, to protect the innocent. but I do have to just call out the ending here, just how gorgeous it is, because, you know, she says in the story, you know, like when Danny left Jamie, you know, she would continue to like look for her in like reflections
she would
run of
the water and leave
stuff
it in
like
the sink
that.
In the tub.
And I mean, the
her.
Very first shot of this entire series is, you know, Carla Gugino's character waking up, you know, in a chair in like a hotel room. Mm-hmm. And you know, we ended in that exact same way. She fills the bathtub with water, looks in there, fills the sink with water, looks in there, leaves
the door open,
like the storyteller said, and lays down in the chair waiting for Danny to come back. And then, like, literally the last shot as we pull out, we see, you know, Jamie's head there resting on there, but we see a hand with a ring on it resting on her shoulder, which clearly means that Danny is still there with her, which, getting me even now. So look, we just recapped a lot of stuff there, just to kind of give some brief commentaries, but
There's a lot more.
And we, you know, we don't need to recap
it all. That's how both of these series are. I mean,
we didn't even dive into Hannah's episode, which is absolutely nuts but gorgeous.
Yeah, there's a whole lot of other things. There's, you know, Owen's mother, and there's...
We didn't get into why Miles got kicked out of boarding school.
No, I mean, the whole Danny and Edmund thing, there's a lot more to it with his ghost following her around. I mean, Henry has another... There's another Henry
grinning ghost Henry that like haunts him all over the place.
Peter has a crazy backstory with his parents.
Yeah,
you feel sorry for him. I mean, you know.
The complexity is nuts.
Yeah, there's so much to unpack. This is just, you know, and it's the same way in Hill House. You could sit here for 2 hours and try to recap it all, but you would forget something.
Yeah,
because there's just so many things that are just there.
Yeah, but I mean, like, just the broad strokes of all this. You're right. It's just like. Man, like, there is no easy story, you know? Like, everybody has complications. Everything is complicated. There's no black and white.
You can't like or even... You can't dislike or really like any of it.
I know, like, even, like, as many dastardly things as Peter does, like, to our eyes in this, at the very end when, like, the ghosts are about to be released and, you know, he just looks at Miles after he's been expelled from his body and is just like, I'm sorry, Miles. Like, I'm so sorry. Like, that's just... Like, heartbreaking.
Like, even, in the episode where they were, like, making the transition and they were about to inhabit him. Like, it's a dick move, but then you, like, see Peter's story and you just are like, oh, well.
I know.
And no, yeah, no, like, no.
Yeah, and like the visualization of that, where like they're ghosts, they're present here, but eventually they always get like pulled back into like their worst memories.
Yeah.
You know, like just the representations of that. And you're right, like Oliver Jackson Cohen, I think his name is. Yes. He played Luke in Hill House, Grown Up Luke, and man, he's great in this series. He
totally
really,
different.
He spans this line from like sociopath to true damaged anti-hero, and I don't know how you make that line work, but somehow he does in all of this.
Yeah, because I mean, he's, you know, besides like Viola, he's I guess the villain.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you would have to, but he's definitely a tragic one.
Yeah, I mean, he even like, you know, when he's with Rebecca, his character totally changes, and this is really just like a desperate ploy to be with her.
Yeah, everything,
you know?
Is.
There's so many things to unpack. I mean, Hannah, we didn't even talk about Hannah's dead, but she literally dies the moment that Danny arrives.
Yeah, so the first time we see her right after her death.
But there's so much about, I mean, I said it like all the way through. I was like, she never eats. I was like, she's dead.
You definitely called
that. I said it like
because
two episodes
of the eating.
I was like, she never eats. She's dead.
She's a ghost. Ghosts can't eat. I knew it. No, but there's, and of course, like if you look for some Easter eggs and stuff, like there's still hidden ghosts hidden all throughout the manor, like Flanagan did in Hill House.
And it's just like the rules of ghosting are so like interesting, because like,
yes,
it's so weird, like how like they can see Hannah and you don't know she's a ghost, but nobody else sees Peter, but like nobody
but
sees Rebecca.
Of,
but it's like,
but that's kind of because Hannah like didn't
doesn't
know
she's a ghost. I mean, that's what I'm saying. There's like rules that go with it.
Yeah, exactly.
Until Hannah like sees her body and knows she's a ghost, like she just goes about her business like normal, and it's like, yeah, really, it's crazy, like the rules of ghosting.
Yeah, but you're right, like and like the just the sheer like care that you take to you know, like make those rules, you know, make those rules actually happen out here. The other people I want to call out though, Rahul Kohli as Owen.
Kohli.
I misread it there. Yeah, Rahul Kohli as Owen. Fantastic. Fantastic.
He's Ted Mosby.
He's definitely Indian Ted Mosby. Let's just put it that way. But
he's great.
He is just so fantastic. I want to listen to him read the phone book. His voice is
like
so great.
You just want to be his friend.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like, he's just very, very calming presence. And, you know, like, he has this, but also, like, Hannah Gross there, played by
Tania Miller.
She is fantastic in this, too. Just very sympathetic.
Such poise.
Yes, very poised, very, like, regal almost looking. But her interactions with Owen are just so adorable. And
I
just
know,
so
it's so
fantastic.
Sad because, you know, she's dead when she finally realizes that her tucked place is basically
the first time she met Owen. Yeah,
and she just wants to stay there with him.
And it's so gorgeous. But ultimately, though, I just love the relationship between Danny and Jamie, played by Amelia Eve. And why can't I ever remember the Violet? Damn it, what's Danny's actress's name?
Victoria Pedretti.
Those two, like, especially in that last episode, the way that they like portray their romance and stuff is just so adorable and so tender, so loving. And, you know, you just really want everything to be okay, even though you know that it's probably not going
to. And yeah, then absolutely call out Kate Siegel as Violet.
Oh man. Kate
Siegel. She doesn't
Siegel
really,
is,
you know, she even in the episode that she's in, it's mostly narrated by the storyteller. So
yeah, she doesn't
talk
speak
that
a ton,
much, but it's just like the, I don't know.
Kate Siegel just has this great presence on screen. You know, like if you're not even just going to think about Hill House, but like also Hush, also directed by her husband, Mike Flanagan, who wrote all of these episodes.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's just really, really, like, she has this presence about her that, like, you know, if you're narrating a story about, like, this BAMF woman from the 1700s, like, that's definitely somebody you would want.
Yeah, she has just, like, such a distinct look. She almost kind of looks like Angelina Jolie if you glance at
A little bit,
look,
especially
right
on
there,
her IMDb.
Jeez,
yeah,
looks just like her, but yeah.
On her IMDb page.
She's
there.
Just a fierce woman. And I love, you know, I hope they keep this up with, like, this American Horror Story, like, grouping of actors
are
just, like, you know, like
Henry Thomas all day, man.
Henry Thomas, Carlo
Gugino.
He's had
some personal demons recently, but keep it going, man.
Victoria Pedretti, Oliver Jackson Cohen, Kate Siegel, they're all returns from the, and then even, like, Alex Esso's in Dr. Sleep, like,
she's
Wendy Torrance.
Yeah.
Like, you know, there's, you just, they pop, all these, like, people just pop up, and I'm sure there's others, but it's just, it's a really cool thing. I like this little group that they've assembled. And there's a new newest one I know is called Midnight Mass. It's a they're taking a pause in the these haunting ones just for this year, and this new one's at 7 episodes. It's called Midnight Mass. Okay. And it has Alex Esso and Annabeth Gish
and my boy Rahul. Hill House.
Yep, he's in it. Kate Siegel's in it. Robert Longstreet, who plays Mr. Dudley.
Yeah, from Hill House. There's Kate Siegel again.
Henry Thomas. Yeah, and it's an isolated island community experiences miraculous events and frightening omens after the arrival of a charismatic, mysterious young priest.
Ooh.
Yeah, so this is the next one that's it's outside of the realm of the hauntings,
right? But still something supernaturally, it looks like. And
yes,
again, man, just
Flanagan.
Like Mike Flanagan. And look, like, enough cannot be said about like the job Mike Flanagan does here, you know, because look, you can see his directing prowess in anything he's done, you know, like movies and stuff. We talked about Oculus last year. You know, Hush, obviously on Netflix, is great. Dr. Sleep. I don't know how you make that.
I love Dr. Sleep. And I don't know.
How you make that book work, but God, he made it work.
I love Stephen King and the way he writes, but any Stephen King novel is very hard to make into a movie because of the length, because it's just like these are so packed with detail, but Flanagan does it really effortlessly.
He didn't even just adapt Dr. Sleep. He actually adapted and kind of
he
reconciled the book of The Shining with Kubrick's Shining.
Yeah, it's really cool.
Which is really, I don't know how you do that.
And like, I know King was really happy with it. I saw a bunch of pictures of like King and Flanagan together, like on
the set. Because it's just like, because if you don't know, like, and I'm sure that the Flashback guys are going to talk about this when they do The Shining later this month. But yeah, like Kubrick did not really
stay true to the book at all.
And he kind of did it on purpose, and he kind of did it just to be a dick to King.
Where the Shining movie is great, it's a cinematic masterpiece. I wish there was a good Shining that stayed true to the book.
I mean, you kind of get half of that with Dr. Sleep, I guess.
I mean, unless you want to watch like that weird Stephen Weber made for TV movie with that stupid kid.
Cortland Mead is not. You can't speak.
Yeah.
But Flanagan just, and you know, like when you watch Hill House, you see that he directed all 10 episodes, wrote all of it. He only directed one episode, the first one of this one, but he still wrote every single episode of this series. And man, the writing in this series is just so great. Nothing is taken for granted. Every narrative piece works so well. Mike Flanagan does, I just love it. I just love everything he does.
If you're going to watch this, just commit to it. Like, there's a perfect example. My mom has, like, a really short attention span.
Right.
And she always asks me, like, a million questions. And she got, like, 4 episodes into this. She goes, I don't think I'm going to watch the rest. I was like, just do me a favor and stick with it.
It's 9 episodes.
And then she texts me after like the 7th episode. She's like, okay, this is really good. And then the next day she's like, oh my God, I'm so glad I finished it.
Because
it really is. It just, you know, it's a slow burn, but it works as a cohesive whole. Don't think of it as episodes. Think about it as like a really long movie.
Yes, exactly.
Honestly, and you're just taking breaks between. Don't stop.
No, don't. If you could watch it all in one sitting, by all means do.
If we didn't have kids, we totally would.
Yeah, exactly. We would do that. Damn kids. I really can't recommend this enough. You're right. Like, the acting is superb. The writing is top notch. And, you know, it bodes well for whatever else in this anthology Mike Flanagan wants to do, because, you know, if this is the story he can tell when it's literally like, this is what a horror ghost love story looks like, I just can't wait. Like, if you're telling me he's about to tell a horror religion story, yeah, please.
Yeah.
Every single thing, just more heapings of that. Please, please, please. I don't know if I have too much more to call out here. Everything is just so fantastic in this series.
It's great. I mean, it's these hauntings, what's so great about them is that they're scary in all the right ways, but they're also so full of emotion.
Yeah, and they're deep. Like,
they are.
They,
I mean,
get to the deep.
There's a section like in the last episode of Hill House, and I've watched Hill House like 3 times fully through now.
Yes.
There's a section that's like the smallest little thing. It's like these side characters, the Dudleys,
mm-hmm.
and like when she dies and she wants to be at the house where her daughter's a ghost, and he carries her old body back to the house and puts her in there just so she can die with her daughter, and he just looks at her and he's like, "We made it, baby. We're here." And I lose it every time.
Yeah.
Like sobbing, wailing, crying.
Yeah.
And it's at this, it's like, and then she looks up and she dies, and she's, you know, he sees her standing there with their little baby that they lost, stillborn, and their little girl that died in the house, and she's young again. It's just like, oh my God. It's just, I know it's like the silliest moment to call out, but it's just so like, it's so emotional, and it just brings you just all of the emotions at once.
Yeah.
And that's how Bly Manor is too.
Yes.
Like we said, every character has things that you like and things you dislike about him. Everyone's complex. It's not just a bunch of teenagers running from a killer.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, it's got much.
It burrows into you, man. Like, yeah. it really just gets down deep. And the thing about it is like, I can't, like, give you, like, the moment where it, like, dug inside me and you know, like, planted itself down. It just kind of happens. The more you watch it, it's just like, you start caring so deeply for all of these characters and you start caring so much about what happens to them. By the time we get to, like, the kind of like the extended epilogue in episode 9, it's just like, you're so invested that you just want everything to be okay. And so, like, the emotional beats that happen when we see the real counterparts and when we see the very end shots of this, it gets inside of you and it just doesn't let you go. And you feel emotions that you never thought a horror thing could ever make.
Well, that's
make
my
you
thing
feel.
I was going to say. My last thing is, like, I didn't go into this watching this to be scared.
No.
Because that's not what you get out of Hill House either. There are some genuine scares, but I think what you go into these watching for is, like, to see what's going to unfold, mm-hmm. to see what is he going to think of next.
Yeah.
And, like, that is what's so great about this and about every episode of Hill House was, like, another, like, oh, man, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, that's how every episode goes. Every episode is just, like, another layer of the onion.
It's like a ghost mystery thing.
It is.
Like, all of these are.
It's like one of those, like, choose-your-own-adventure things. It's like you're thinking, like, oh, shit, what's going to happen now? Like, that's why I like them. I don't go into this like I go into watching, like, I don't know, Scream or something, a horror movie, just wanting to, like, have gross out scares. Watching these is like an experience.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like
exactly.
Every episode is just like, oh shit, what are they going to think of next?
Exactly,
you know?
Yeah.
And you can't wait to get you don't want to get to the end because you don't want it to be over, but you also, like, can't wait to see what they're going to unpack in the next episode.
Yeah. In much the same way, like Hill House is a ghost story that's more about how a family heals itself. You know, through the interactions that they've had with these ghostly presences. Blind Manor is, again, in a similar way, all of these people learning to heal themselves and learning to better themselves in the midst of a ghost story. It's the human emotions that come through in Hill House, and it's the human emotions that come through in Blind Manor.
Yeah, the ghost stories are definitely secondary to the human relationships.
Yeah, so, I mean, like, and that's, I think, why Flanagan's just on another plane, is because he's writing great human drama.
Watch these and go, oh, it's not scary. Well, that's not the point.
It's not the point.
Yes, it
really is
scary. There are a lot of scary things, but that's not what your main goal in watching.
Yeah, I mean, like, I'm far less interested in seeing, you know, Viola come out of the lake and kill somebody as I am
knowing why
she's doing it and seeing the beauty with which they make that story come to life.
Yeah.
That's way more interesting to me than seeing, like, some grotesque kill.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, so I mean, like, just broaden your minds, people. Look at Cora D'Angelo's tweet. She encapsulated perfectly. It's just like horror can encapsulate so many different things. It can be a twisted love story. It can be just these emotions that you can feel, like the Blind Manor makes you feel.
Yep.
And, you know, like, I just think that that's beautiful. So,
okay.
The more you know. Okay. That's going to do it for this episode of Full Disclosure. Thank you so much. Monster Cast Month continues to plow on. You've probably just heard Sarah and I on Are You Afraid of the Podcast doing the Long Ago Locket. Hey, guess what? You're going to hear us tomorrow because we're on the next episode of this one. You also probably just heard us breaking down our third Monster Cast of the month with I Know What You Did Last Summer and I Still Know What You Did Last Summer. But tomorrow we're bringing you the next and last two films in the Welcome to Blumhouse anthology. We're going to be bringing you our little mini review of Evil Eye and
Nocturne.
So look out for that. And then, of course, we still have one more Monster Cast spotlight of the month, The Ruins, which we will be releasing on Halloween Day. And one more Are You Afraid of the Podcast on The Tale of the Water Demons. So
man, I thought we were close to done.
We were almost done. Almost there. Look,
and then
I'm
taking a break for a year.
Yes, then we're taking year-long breaks.
No, we're not.
Or Are You Afraid of the Podcast? Crowd should be very used to that. All right, so if you want to know more from MonsterCast or the Front Row Network, go to frontrownetwork.com or frnpod.com or the nprillinois.org/programs-frontrownetwork. And of course, you can find us on social media, Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, The Front Row Network, and follow us on Twitter at Front Row Reviews with a Z. All right, that's going to do it for this episode of Full Disclosure here in MonsterCast Month 2024, The Front Row Network. I'm Jeremy Gechner.
I'm Sarah Baltusevich-Gechner.
And we will see you in the front row. Go watch Blind Manor. Now.
Go watch it now. I'm going to watch it
go,
again.
Go.
Bye. Please say honestly you won't give up on me. I shall be pleased.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Front Row Network, a proud Community Voices member of National Public Radio Illinois. For more from the Front Row Network, including our articles or our other dozens of shows, visit thefrontrownetwork.com or nprillinois.org/programs/frontrownetwork. You can also find us on social media by searching for the Front Row Network on Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram, and on Twitter @FrontRowReviews with a Z.